The Orb, Volume 2, Number 6. Obedience. Hello, welcome to The Orb. My name is Reed Hart. While considering a theme for this episode, I was walking around one of the many beaches near my home. I live in Vancouver, Canada, and to my very good fortune, close to the ocean. There is a secluded beach where people are permitted to allow their dogs to run free off-leash. About 3 minutes along, there is another beach where dogs are not allowed. Now, I am a cat person. I don't care much for dogs. Cats don't require time outdoors to run and, well, do other stuff. As I was walking along, I got to thinking about the dog owners that allow and indeed walk their dogs off-leash and on the beach where it is not allowed. What is it about them that they can't take their dogs the few minutes farther along to the beach where dogs are allowed? I'll admit that this is rather petty. I'll admit I don't own a dog. Most importantly, I'll admit that there are plenty of rules that I choose to ignore. I park without putting a few coins in the meter. I drive the judicious 10 clicks over the limit. I'm not necessarily any different than those people with their dogs on the beach. What is it about the rules, and about us as individuals, that doesn't always connect? Why do we obey some rules and not others?
Tick-tock, tick-tock, it's time to obey. Boom, boom. Obey what I say. Boom, boom. Obey right away. Boom, boom. Obey, don't delay. Tick-tock, tick-tock, it's time to obey. Boom, boom. Obey what your parents say. Boom, boom. Obey right away. Boom, boom. Obey, don't delay. Tick-tock, tick-tock, tick-tock. Don't say no, don't say I don't want to, don't ask can I have 5 minutes and do it later on. Just obey the right things we say and you can have a wonderful day. Just obey the right things we say and you can have a wonderful day.
Just obey the right things we say. How do I know which ones are the right ones? Parents struggle to keep their children obedient. Kids are supposed to respect their elders and do as they're told. We love them. We wouldn't mislead them. Except for those adults that do. It's not nearly as simple as we'd wish.
Obedience is listening attentively. Obedience will take instructions joyfully. Obedience heeds wishes of authority. And obedience will follow orders instantly. For when I am busy at my work or play, and someone calls my name, I'll answer right away. I'll be ready with a smile to go the extra mile. As soon as I can say, yes, sir, yes, ma'am.
Obedience heeds authority. Yes, sir, yes, ma'am. Obedience includes an implication of consent with the authority being obeyed. I choose to obey rules because I respect the authority that has made the rule. It certainly helps if I understand the motives of those making the rules. Why does the rule exist? Where a rule exists that seems to defy any logic, it can draw a much lower level of obedience. To actually be obeyed, it must also avoid imposing an inconvenience on people. Disagreement with a rule that imposes an inconvenience gets us into the territory of compliance. Compliance is behavior to follow the instruction of an authority without agreement with the instruction. I may be stopped by a security guard who asks me to show the contents of a bag I'm carrying. I can choose to comply because that may appear the path of least resistance, rather than getting into a long argument over just what the search and seizure laws are. Conformity is behavior influenced by a group intended to fit in. Again, there is no implication of consent to the rules, just compliance. I may join a group that has rules I don't particularly agree with, like wearing a uniform, but I comply because I gain other rewards from being with the group. Obedience is something more. Real obedience is something deeper within that says this rule is for a greater good, and I shall obey for that greater good. It may be for my good, my safety, that I obey a rule. More often, it is for the benefit of those around me.
R-E-S-P-E-C-T, respect authority, O-B-E-Y. Obey authority, come on, come on. Respect authority, come on, come on. Obey authority, come on, come on. Authorities are here to help you do what they say. And everything will be okay. Come on, respect authority, come on, come on, obey authority. But first of all, pray for all who are in authority, so that we can live in peace and happiness. Respect authority.
Authorities are here to help you. Do what they say and everything will be okay. Aw. All right. I know that song is written and performed in sarcasm. Authority comes from a few sources. Some we elect, that's the common source for most of us. Some we follow because they are charismatic. Consider Jim Jones and the cyanide-laced Flavor Aid. It wasn't actually Kool-Aid. In 1961, Yale University psychologist Stanley Milgram started his famous experiments. It was just a few months after the trial started for Adolf Eichmann. Milgram wanted to know, was it that Eichmann and his accomplices in the Holocaust had mutual intent, in at least with regard to the goals of the Holocaust? In other words, was there a mutual sense of morality among those involved? Milgram's testing suggested that it could have been that the accomplices were merely following orders, despite violating their deepest moral beliefs. The setup was a memory experiment. A volunteer subject drew one of two slips of paper, not knowing they both said teacher. The other slip was drawn by an actor, a confederate of the experiment, who claimed it said learner. They were then separated into different rooms where they could communicate but not see each other. The teacher was given an electric shock as a sample of the shock that the learner would receive during the experiment. They were to teach the learner a list of word pairs. A shock, with the voltage increasing in 15-volt increments, was administered for each wrong answer. In reality, there were no shocks. The actor playing the learner set up a tape recorder that played pre-recorded sounds for each shock level. After a number of voltage level increases, the actor started to bang on the wall that separated him from the subject. After several times banging on the wall and complaining, all responses by the learner would cease. At this point, many people indicated their desire to stop the experiment and check on the learner. Some test subjects paused at 135 volts and began to question the purpose of the experiment. Most continued after being assured that they would not be held responsible. There was a set of four verbal prods from the experimenter should the subject indicate a desire to quit. Please continue. The experiment requires that you continue. It is absolutely essential that you continue. You have no other choice. You must go on. If the subject still wished to stop after all four verbal prods, the experiment was halted. Otherwise, it was halted after the subject had given the maximum 450-volt shock three times in succession. The experimenter also gave special prods if the teacher made specific comments. If the teacher asked whether the learner might suffer permanent physical harm, the experimenter replied, "Although the shocks may be painful, there is no permanent tissue damage, so please go on." If the teacher said that the learner clearly wants to stop, the experimenter replied, "Whether the learner likes it or not, you must go on until he has learned all the word pairs correctly, so please go on." Although 14 senior year psychology majors predicted an average of 1.2% would go the distance, in Milgram's first set of experiments, 65% of actual participants administered the final 450-volt shock, though many were very uncomfortable doing so. At some point, every participant paused and questioned the experiment. Milgram wrote in 1974 that stark authority was pitted against the subject's strongest moral imperatives, against hurting others. And with the subject's ears ringing with the screams of the victims, authority won more often than not. Ordinary people, simply doing their jobs, and without any particular hostility on their part, can become agents in a terrible destructive process. Moreover, even when the destructive effects of their work become patently clear, and they are asked to carry out instructions incompatible with fundamental standards of morality, relatively few people have the resources needed to resist authority. As ethically challenging as this experiment was, it did yield some impressive results. At the height of the Vietnam War, one of the participants sent correspondence to Milgram explaining why he was glad to have participated despite the stress. Quote, "While I was a subject in 1964, though I believed that I was hurting someone, I was totally unaware of why I was doing so. Few people ever realize when they are acting according to their own beliefs and when they are meekly submitting to authority. To permit myself to be drafted with the understanding that I am submitting to authority's demand to do something very wrong would make me frightened of myself. I am fully prepared to go to jail if I am not granted conscientious objector status. Indeed, it is the only course I could take to be faithful to what I believe. My only hope is that members of my board act equally according to their conscience." Unquote. In case you're thinking people were more obedient in the 60s, you need to know that the experiment continues to be run. In 2009, BBC ran it as part of the Horizon series. Of 12 participants, only 3 refused to go the distance. In 2010, it was the French in a documentary called The Game of Death. They staged it as a reality TV show pilot and told participants they couldn't win anything, they just get paid 40 euros. 20% chose to leave the game early. 80% went the distance. As recently as the 30th of October 2011, Discovery Channel aired How Evil Are You?, a segment of the Curiosity program. They got results similar to those of the original Milgram experiment. No, we're still as obedient, or at least as compliant. Milgram suggested a couple of theories on this. One theory is that of agency. The subject comes to view themselves as an instrument of someone else. It's not me doing this. I'm just pressing the button because that other guy with the lab coat told me to. They dissociate from the moral decision and become a machine. The other theory aligns with conformance. A subject who lacks the expertise to make a decision cedes decision-making to a group or hierarchy. The group becomes the person's behavioral model. Solomon Ash of Swarthmore College had run the following experiment. Each participant was put into a group with others who were experiment confederates. The group were shown a card with a line on it, followed by another card with three lines labeled A, B, and C. They were then asked to say which line matched the length of the line on the first card. The real participant answered last or next to last. There were 18 trials in total, and the Confederates answered incorrectly for 12 of them. The aim was to see whether the real participant would change their answer and respond in the same way as the group, despite it being the wrong answer. Results showed that when surrounded by individuals all voicing an incorrect answer, participants provided incorrect responses 32% of the time. When the Confederates are not unanimous in their judgment, even if only one voices a different opinion, participants are much more likely to resist the urge to conform. This finding illuminates the power that even a small dissenting minority can have. Interestingly, this finding holds whether or not the dissenting Confederate gives the correct answer. As long as the dissenting Confederate gives an answer that is different from the majority, participants are more likely to give the correct answer. Another of Milgram's associates, Yale finance professor Robert Shiller, argued that people have learned that when experts tell them something is all right, it probably is, even if it doesn't seem so. In fact, it is worth noting that in Milgram's case, the experimenter was indeed correct. It was all right to continue giving the shocks, even though most of the subjects did not suspect the reason. In 1966, Charles Hoffling conducted a field experiment. This was conducted in the field with unprepared real-world participants. A fictional doctor telephoned the subject, a nurse who did not know the caller, and instructed the nurse to administer 20 milligrams of Astrotin, a fictional drug, to a real patient. The doctor said he would complete the paperwork when he arrived at the hospital later that day. A bottle of the drug had been planted in the cabinet in advance. The label on the bottle admonished that 10 milligrams was the recommended maximum daily dose. Of 22 nurses tested, 21 would have administered the drug. They were stopped at the patient's door to prevent any harm. The high opinion of doctors and the standards of the profession had induced nurses to suppress their own good judgment. All these tests get us to the point where we are investing our trust in the authority. The word authority implies a legitimacy, whereas power can be raw and does not require consent. A mob may have the power to punish a criminal, and they do. However, only a court of law has the authority to punish a criminal. Consider the role of military training. Soldiers are initially ordered to do seemingly trivial things, such as picking up the sergeant's hat off the floor, or marching and standing in formation. The orders gradually become more demanding, until an order to the soldiers to place themselves into the midst of gunfire gets an instinctively obedient response. I continue to be astonished at this. It demands that you take on the agency that Milgram discussed. The soldier is just a tool wielded by others, a jarhead into which you can pour any atrocity. The soldier does not have a moral investment in what is happening and simply obeys the authority of officers. Officers may attempt to absolve themselves by saying they did not do the deed. That was the soldier. The situation attempts to remove morals in their entirety. What we learn from the Ash experiments is that groupthink, although an impressive force, requires unanimity. When any one takes a different choice, it frees others to assert their own moral judgments. When Henry David Thoreau wrote in his essay on civil disobedience that people must not just wait passively for an opportunity to vote for justice, because voting for justice was as ineffective as wishing for justice, what you need to do is to actually be just. This is not to say that you have an obligation to devote your life to fighting for justice, but you do have an obligation not to commit injustice and not to give injustice your practical support. In a constitutional republic like the United States, people often think that the proper response to an unjust law is to try to use the political process to change the law, but to obey and respect the law until it is changed. But if the law is itself clearly unjust, and the lawmaking process is not designed to quickly obliterate such unjust laws, then Thoreau says the law deserves no respect and should be broken. Antigone, written by Sophocles in 442, depicts civil disobedience. The title character defies an order of Creon to leave one of her brothers dead on the battlefield following a civil war. It is a disgrace that she considers defiant of the gods. She argues to Creon, "And if I have to die before my time, well, I count that a gain. When someone has to live the way I do, surrounded by so many evil things, how can she fail to find a benefit in death? And so for me, meeting this fate won't bring any pain. But if I'd allowed my own mother's dead son to just lie there, an unburied corpse, then I'd feel distress. If you think what I'm doing now is stupid, perhaps I'm being charged with foolishness by someone who's a fool." We are surrounded by rules and by authorities. Some we respect, some we tolerate, and some we downright detest. Our obedience to these authorities is always in flux. In the end, we are each our own moral authority. Each must decide for themselves what the right thing to do is, and be prepared to pay the price should an unjust authority impose sentence.
Long as I remember being bent coming down, clouds of mystery pouring, confusion on the ground. Could be through the ages, trying to find the sun. And
I live in a strata condominium. I've been on the strata council and I've been involved in writing bylaws. This process has taught me the real meaning of the rules we set. Contrary to what many might believe, we are not trying to control behavior. The rules we set are set not to catch someone out, but rather to resolve conflicts. We have a rule that you're not allowed to run a commercial enterprise out of your suite. That is intended to avoid things like hydroponic marijuana operations or a high-traffic retail-style business. A biweekly podcast website is a commercial venture, but it doesn't bother anyone. No one complains. No problem. Am I disobedient? Technically, yes. Practically, no. The rules that we create serve many purposes. Some have clear benefits in safety and development. Others seem petty and stupid. We pick and choose which we obey, which we will comply with, and which we will defy. We don't all make the same choices. There's the rub. The Orb is a listener-supported presentation of Cornoble Productions. New podcasts are released alternate Mondays at orbcast.ca or pick us up at iTunes. I'm Reed Hart.